Dave Crippen from the Archives of the Henry Ford Museum. And this is August 1st, and another one of our interviews of seminal industrial designers, in this case, Mr. William Bill Schmidt, who has had a brilliant career as an independent industrial designer after a long career at Ford and elsewhere. We are going to let Mr. Schmidt tell his story in his own way.
Dave, I started out in Ford Motor Company in 1940, just prior to the war, as a tool designer. And, of course, the major item at that time was the B-24 bomber at the Willow Run Bomber Plant. And I was sent up there to work on tools, jigs, and fixtures. During the process, the prints were coming in from California, Consolidated Aircraft, and they were very large prints, 24 feet long, 10 feet wide, and 20 deep, and very difficult to understand for somebody who hadn't worked on aircraft before. So I started making little sketches of what the prints meant, like we'd take a nose wheel of a bomber. I'd put a little sketch up in the corner to make it more clear to myself of exactly how all the components went together and the sub-assemblies, and it became easily understood. One day I got a call from Mr. Piok, who was Vice President of Engineering for Ford at the Bomber Plant.
Bill Piok?
Bill Piok. And Bill said, are you responsible for putting these sketches up in the corner of these very valuable secret prints from Consolidated? At that moment, I thought I was lost. I said, yes, sir. He said, why did you do that? And I told him why. He said, we found out that when those prints went down on the floor, the people down on the floor were able to put the plane together a lot faster because they could look at your sketch and understand what it was about, and then they got into the prints for the detail. He said, we estimate that it has speeded up our production by three times. And my question is, could you do that on all the prints that are coming from Consolidated? I was 19 at the time, and it seemed like a Herculean task, so I said, well, I think if I had some other people who were qualified in the same business of techno illustration, I could. He said, go get them. So I went down and I started hiring people, and we had about 35 people in 2 weeks, and we started the Department of Technical Illustration. And we started making all of the drawings of all the components of the plane, plus all the jigs and fixtures, assembly lines, and told quite a story. And basically, that was the bomber plant story. It became very successful, and we also used it at the tank plant, and where we made the ducts that were made by Ford, and the glider systems, and so on. So we had about five departments making technical illustrations. And that's really where I started my drawing, because prior to that at college, I'd been studying to be an attorney, and this was strictly an aside issue with me. When the war was winding its way down, I left Willow Run Bomber Plant with about 16 of my people and was assigned to Ford Styling. And Bob Gregory was the man who was the director of styling. And I went in, and since I didn't know a great deal about automobile design, we just put in advanced styling to design the cars of the future, which is a little funny story, but really they didn't have any place to put us right away. At that time, there were 11 people in styling. I understand today there's something like 1,200 people in styling. Worked on the 1949 cars and the Continentals, and my first complete automobile was a little French Ford that we designed as a small car for the United States.
Excuse me, Bill, may I interrupt for a moment? We found some marvelous photographs of clays being made in the early, about 1944, of presumably post-war car shapes. Was your department responsible for those?
That's the one. We did 13 scale models, mm-hmm. clays.
Yeah.
And actually, there wasn't enough room in the complex there to do our work, so we were sent out to the terminal building at the airport, in the Ford airport. My office was a little cupola up at the top with a spiral staircase going up, And we made 13 small models and a full size of those that Mr. Gregory approved. It was interesting.
Post-war cars.
Yes, post-war. What are we going to do when we come out with a new car? And at that time, it was very exciting because we had Mr. Henry Ford came back from college to take over the reins of the company. And he was assigned for 2 weeks to advanced styling and 2 weeks to purchasing and 2 weeks to engineering and so on. So it was my responsibility to show him what we were doing and make him familiar with our processes. Shortly thereafter, Benson Ford and Bill Clay Ford both had a two-week session. So I got to know the Ford family very well on a very personal nature. And it helped me a great deal in my career. We then started out on a, well, to continue the Ford story, the Vedette, it was designed as a small car for the United States. But the Ford management looked at it and said it was too small for the United States, and people in the United States weren't interested in small cars. And unbeknownst to me, it was shipped to France. They tooled it, put it in production. And the first inkling I had of that is when I went over to the Paris Automobile Show some years later, and here are thousands and thousands of them running around the streets, and it was very exciting for me. So that was my first Ford car.
Did you ever want to acquire a Vedette? Have you thought about it?
Oh yeah, I couldn't afford it. At that time, of course, the salaries were very low, and I couldn't afford it. Coming back into the styling as it really started to proceed, they divided styling up into a different groups. They had an exterior group and an interior group, and I was given the exterior design for all cars, Ford, Mercury, Lincoln, tractor, and truck.
And were you working for Gregory at that time?
No, Mr. Gregory had left, and Tom Hibbard came in as the director at that time. And I believe Bob McGuire was the director of interiors. Is thinking a long way back, but he's in charge of all interiors, and he started bringing in a lot of GM stylists and build up the staff. Gene Bourdonnais came over, and he was my boss, and he was the assistant to Tom Hibbert. And they had a series of different directors at that time. Charlie Waterhouse became director for a while, a very nice gentleman. And George Snyder came over from GM under John Oswald, and he was a director for a while.
Were these breach moves, do you think?
I would say Mr. Breach brought in John Oswald. John Oswald brought in George Snyder because he'd worked with him at GM.
Right.
Mr. Snyder was a difficult man to work with, and we didn't get on well together. So I was demoted from, I guess my title was chief stylist of exteriors, and gave me a job of opening up an instrument panel studio, which is a pretty bad thing. There was no instrument panel studio at the time, so I was about ready to leave Ford at that time. However, we put together a team of five or six very good designers, Dave Ash and Stan Thorwaldsen, Don Byrus. There were quite a few really capable people. And we came out with the first 1951 Ford instrument panels and the 49 Lincolns and Mercurys, and they were big successes, so we came out looking pretty good. And then Mr. Snyder was sent to Europe and left the Ford empire here. And I was called in by Mr. Oswald, and I had my choice of studios. So I was given the Lincoln Mercury design studio.
What year was this?
47.
47.
And Bob McGuire was given the Ford studio. Gil Spear was given the advanced studio. And so we had both the interiors, instrument panels, and exteriors, but just for the Lincoln Mercury cars. So for 9 years, then I was in charge of Lincoln Mercury, and I really enjoyed it. And during that time, we came up with a lot of award-winning vehicles. I had an excellent team, and styling didn't have a great deal of power because it was still under engineering. But as we progressed, we had better acceptance with our top engineers, and we got a good working relationship. And our management, Mr. Benson Ford in particular, was always excited by show cars. So I started doing, on the side, during lunch hours and evenings and so on, sketches of special show cars that we could make from our existing vehicles. And we obtained quite a few okays to go ahead and build one. So we came up with a series of cars like the Maharaja, the Carnival, the Yachtsman, and there must have been 15 cars that we did in Lincoln Mercury Studio, and Ford Studio did the same. And of course, Advanced Styling was always doing new show cars with Alex Tremulous and Gil Spear and so on. Then the new cars coming out were to be the 52 line of Lincoln and Mercury's. And we designed full-size clay models that had the first high bumpers on them. And they were very exciting new vehicles. And we finally sold Mr. McPherson, who was Vice President of Engineering, on the concept. And he literally sold top management on going that way. So the first new line of cars were the 52 Mercury's and the 52 Lincoln's. And they were very small cars compared to Cadillac and to Oldsmobile, which was our competition. But very successful in that they were contemporary, simple, and clean. And it started to put Lincoln Mercury on the road to success. Up until that time, Lincoln had a pretty bad story, a very exclusive car, but really not a very handsomely designed car, other than the Continental. The 52 Lincolns became the Pan American road racing cars. And we won first, second, third, and fourth place 4 years in a row at the Pan American races. Really put Lincoln on the map as a real gutsy car. And then after the Lincoln and the Mercury run of 52, they were on till 55 with faceless each year. 1956, we came out with an all new car. This was to be a much longer car, a bigger car to be more competitive with Cadillac. And I did a model in the back room behind some screens of a model I thought would be a good answer. I really didn't have authority to do that. So the modelers spent a lot of time, when they would normally just be relaxing, working on that model for me. The day of the show came in the showroom, and we wheeled in the Lincolns that we had ready for the show. We had the 14 vice presidents and top management of Ford Motor Company there. Mr. Breach said he didn't feel they were competitive. He said, "Don't we have something different, that something that really would be exciting?" So I mentioned to Mr. Breach on the side that I had a model he might like to see in the back room. He walked back with me while the meeting broke up for lunch. Saw it. It was 12 inches longer and pretty exciting low lines and so on. So let's wheel it into the showroom. So we did. We wheeled it in the showroom. When lunch was over, they all came back, and Mr. Breach said, "Here's what I think should be the 56 Lincoln." Mr. McPherson objected because he wasn't after big cars, because it required bigger engines and bigger brakes and so on. And he put up quite an argument. But eventually, it was almost a unanimous decision. And that did become the 56 Lincoln. It's a real classic today. It's one of the best cars we ever did. At the same time, we did a show car called the Lincoln Futura. And the Futura was a dream car. What would we be doing 10, 15 years down the road type of thing? Really not practical from a production standpoint. It had an all-glass bubble roof, which you couldn't make at that time and so on. And it was completely air-conditioning, so he had no windows that would drop. So I did a couple of sketches, which I took over to Mr. Benson Ford, and showed him this dream car. And he asked how much it would cost, and I told him roughly $250,000 to build it, but we could get it built at Ghia in Italy. And he gave us authority to go ahead and do it. So we made a small model and a full-size model, and I had Roy Brown working with me as my assistant at that time. And he did a great job on the clay modeling, and I went over to Europe. We had it built by Ghia. It came back, and we put it in the New York show, and the Chicago show, and the Los Angeles show, and we won top honors for Ford. It was a very good success story. In addition, it was used as a public relations vehicle for Lincoln Mercury Division.
That we have a shot of you and Ben driving it down Fifth Avenue.
All right. Yeah, we took it to New York. We drove down Fifth Avenue, and we were supposed to come out at the Tavern on the Green, where all of TV cameras and Dave Garraway was there to interview Mr. Ford. And we drove down Fifth Avenue, and the air conditioning on the car went out. Of course, there are no windows that you could drop. And we're dressed in blue shirts with makeup on for the TV. Must have been 105 degrees inside that car. We got out sopping wet, trying to look nonchalant and so on. And man, it was just terrible. But it came off very good. You really couldn't pick it up on TV. I saw it later. So we had a good show. And then the following week, it was in the Ed Sullivan Show. And Mr. Ford and I went down to the Ed Sullivan Show, and he interviewed both of us and put us on TV and announced the car, and 80 million people saw that TV show. It just amazed me. And so we got to see how they handled the show and so on.
Were you ever able to get a kinescope for that?
No, I never did. Yeah. No.
Sullivan was sponsored by Lincoln Mercury in those years.
Oh, yes. He was Mr. Lincoln Mercury.
Right. Yeah.
So that was an exciting car. And then at that time, I had an opportunity to move to Studebaker Packard Corporation.
Excuse me, before you leave Ford, was there, did you mention that you worked on the Continental 1950X?
Yes, I did some work on that for about 6 to 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bill Clayford set up a separate division just to do the Continental.
Right.
John Reinhardt, who was one of my designers, went over as the chief designer on it, and he was responsible for the design, not me.
Yeah.
He did a great job, and Harley Kopp was his chief engineer.
Right.
And they put together a fine automobile. They tried to keep as much of the flavor of the original Continentals as they could, but with today's technology. It didn't sell as well as we'd anticipated, and it was dropped some years later.
Mm-hmm.
But they really did an excellent job on it. Yeah. It must have been a great team they had. It was a small team. And of course, with Bill Clayford hitting it up, they had the ear of the management.
Youth and enthusiasm.
Yeah, and Bill is a very intelligent guy, quick to understand what you're trying to do, very receptive to new ideas, easy to talk to. He's a great man to hit up a project like that.
Before you leave the Futura, can you give us the final chapter in that story? What has happened to it?
The car was shown for approximately 7 years in all of the major shows, sent back to Europe, put in the European Paris show, the Hamburg show, and so on. Then it came back over here, and the public relations people put it into the dealerships around the country, Lincoln Mercury dealerships, to draw crowds and so on. After that time, they were going to scrap it. But George Barris, the Hollywood car builder, came to Detroit, talked to somebody, and bought it for $7,000. Mm. Here's a $250,000 car plus all the engineering and hidden costs that go into it. He bought it for $7,000. He took it out there and sprayed it black and put pipes on it and made it into the Batmobile. And it became probably the world's most famous car as the Batmobile.
Now, is the actual original prototype doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No, I believe that was ruined while they were making the films.
Mm-hmm.
But George, I was told, built 8 copies of it. And he leased these to the studios for the Batmobile pictures. He became very wealthy as a result of that car.
And I believe you were talking the other day that he has sold at least what he claims is the original product.
Yeah, and it may be that he reconditioned it and so on. He sold it recently, I think this last year, for about $74,000.
Yeah.
So he bought it for $7,000, sold it for $74,000, and made $1 million in between. So he called me frequently. I went out to his home and visited he and his wife, very nice people. And he said, Bill, for God's sakes, design another Futura. It was an interesting story.
Do you remember any of the other dream cars that you had a direct hand in the 50s, up to the mid-50s?
Well, there were a great many, one of which was 50th anniversary of Ford Motor Company. And we could look that up. I don't know what the date is, but
53.
We did a 53.
Mm-hmm.
We did a Lincoln, all gold plated with a white pearl finish, and all the hardware is gold plated and so on. That was the 50th anniversary Lincoln. That was shown all over the United States. We did, boy, so many show cars in
those
days.
Did you mention the XM 500 as being one of
yours? Oh, I forgot that.
Yeah.
We did the XM 500, which was the first show car we did that was all new body.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of taking a 52 Lincoln or a Mercury and revising and modifying it to become a show car, here was a complete new car built on a Lincoln chassis. And it was the forerunner of the 56 front end.
Really?
The X500 front end was literally taken from the show car and put on the 56 Lincoln at a later date. And it was a very nice workout. At the same time it was done, Elwood Engel had come in with George Walker and they built an X100.
Oh, yeah.
So they had the X100 and the X500 as two show cars in the same year.
Do you remember the 1950X Continental as the prototype of the Mark II, perhaps?
I must say, I'm not too familiar at this date with the cars, but the Continentals I had to do with were in the very early 40s, before John Reinhardt and Bill Ford set up their division. After that, I had nothing to do with them whatsoever. They were taken out of Lincoln Mercury Division and given to Bill Ford.
How about the XM800? Was that part of your show?
That was a Mercury, as I believe,
mm-hmm.
and it was basically done by Don Della Rosa.
Ah.
I didn't have anything to do with that car.
So yours is the Futura and the XM500.
Those were the two main cars, right. And of course, the production car, the 56 Lincoln, that was exciting. Yeah.
The award winner. Before you describe your career change, were you reasonably happy at Ford in your role there? Did you have did you feel that you had good rapport with the group that has just come in?
I was very happy at Ford. They treated me extremely well. I was given a lot of leeway and opportunity that I don't think you could get today because their systems were different.
Mm-hmm.
And top management was very close to styling at that time. My personal relationship with Mr. Benson Ford was excellent. And I'd see him almost every day, and any new concepts, I'd go right over to him
mm-hmm.
and almost pre-sell before any major shows came up.
Right.
And Mr. Ford would go in the meeting and say, here's the way I want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a wonderful relationship there. They treated me fine. I really enjoyed it. There was always some politics with management.
Mm-hmm.
I had a problem, I might say, with Mr. Snyder and I not seeing eye to eye. And of course, he was director of styling, so that sent me back to the instrument panel studio for a while, but we worked out of that all right. When Mr. Walker came in with his two men, both fine gentlemen, Joe Orris and Elwood Engel, were excellent designers, but they were Walker men,
mm-hmm.
and George was very much an extrovert,
mm-hmm.
good salesman, not basically a designer as such,
mm-hmm.
but had the ear of Mr. Breach and top management, and had done a really good job on the 49-4.
Mm-hmm.
He really came in with a new body,
mm-hmm.
so he earned his position, and Mr. Breach brought him in and put him in charge of styling.
Was Joe Orris one of his lieutenants also?
Yes, Joe and Elwin.
Joe and Elwin,
and they were very capable people. But at that time, it appeared to me that the top management positions were not open to me anymore.
Yeah.
And I'd been offered a job at Studebaker Packard as a vice president. So
you were receptive to this executive hunt that you were
involved in. Yes.
Can you tell us a bit of some of the details about that?
Well, actually, it occurred over a period of 2 years. I was first approached by an executive research corporation, and I didn't even know what company they were representing. But evidently, a lot of the Lincoln Mercury top executives, Ray Powers, Mr. Taylor, who was chief engineer, there were about four or five. Roger Bremer was a Lincoln Mercury product planning man who went over to Packard. And they talked to Mr. Nance about what they needed was a brand new styling department. And they thought I'd designed so many hot cars that I was the right guy. I was 33 years old at that time. So they kept seeing me about every other month for about 2 years and finally made the offer so great that I just thought I'd better take it.
So James J. Nance was president of Studebaker at that time?
Yes, he was. A fine gentleman and just a tremendous man. The same caliber as Mr. Breach, in my estimation. You know, as you go through industry, you find certain executives who really are driving forces.
Mm-hmm.
I consider Mr. Breach to probably be the greatest of that type that I ever saw. Mr. Cusso is also the same caliber. And I think Mr. Nance was the same caliber. And he personally offered me a tremendous contract and a capability of doing more than just designing the cars, but actually operating the full department and hiring the people, firing the people, coming up with what we thought they should be, the car-wise. And when I went in, they had a man who had been at Packard for many years and part of the Packard family, Mr. McCauley, who was director of styling. And I said, well, Jim, I'd love to come over and I'll be glad to do the job, but you can't have two roosters in the same hen house. I'm afraid if I come in, Mr. McCauley has to move. And he says, no problem. I've already talked to him and he agrees anything that's good for Packard, he'll be glad to do. He was a real fine gentleman. So I went over and we laid out a program of cars where we had one body working for Packard and Studebaker since it was a combination.
When had that coalition taken place?
55, just before I got there, 54 perhaps. But just
was a consolidation due to the contraction of their respective automotive markets?
Well, Jim Nance was basically responsible for putting the companies together. He thought their marketing would be better. They could make engines in one plant and make them for both and so on.
Sure.
He was also trying to get American Motors to go in at the same time. It would have been a combination of three companies. That never happened, but he was working on it. So in going over there, we did a new line of Packards, a new line of Clippers, a new line of Studebakers, and a very famous show car called the Packard Predictor. And that was the show car of that year. And we had that built at GIA. We won all the top awards at that time with the Predictor.
Can you describe that in some detail, the Packard Predictor?
Well, the Packard Predictor was an all-pearl white show car with basically a glass top, roll top, doors that rolled right up into the roof like a tambour door on a garage door. It had the first shock absorber system on the front end with hydraulic cylinders absorbing shock on impact. It was a real show car in the sense that it predicted things to come on Packards. That's what we were telling the dealers at that time. So we called it the Predictor. We had a national TV show, a closed circuits TV system where Mr. Nance announced the car, and then I came on and described the car and walked around the car and showed it to all the dealers, and it kept a lot of dealers with Packard for another year or so, because at that time dealers were leaving Packard like mad, as you can imagine. They didn't have the products to sell.
What was happening to the industry at that time? Why was the Packard Studebaker market contracting at that point?
The dealers,
this is the mid-50s?
Yes, 55. Yeah. The dealers were the biggest problem. We didn't have successful dealers who could merchandise the product.
Mm-hmm.
At that time they had enough money. I think they spent $54 million on tooling the new Packard body.
Mm-hmm.
They had enough money to do it, but they didn't have money to put it in production. So it never reached the thing. We took the Predictor concept, put it onto what we were calling the 57 Packard at that time. And the 57 Packard was almost a direct copy of the Predictor, not quite as showy and a much more Packard-type automobile. We built one. John DeLorean was the chief engineer on that.
Was he?
Yeah. John was a young man at that time. He was very, very capable and had a great deal of charisma. An excellent speaker. He was assistant chief body engineer to Herb Misch, who was chief body engineer, who later went to Ford as vice president. And they all worked for Bill Graves, who was vice president of engineering at Packard, who is now a professor at the University of Michigan.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So they had a good engineering team, and young John DeLorean was the man assigned to me to design the 57 engineering. We worked together for about 2.5 years, and then he went to Pontiac when Packard was breaking up. But it was a good relationship, and he's changed somewhat since that time.
A bit. So this is in 55, and already you're getting intimations that there are problems at Studebaker Packard.
Yes, it was a pretty obvious thing, and we were getting ready to close down when we received word from Mr. Nance that the vice president of design at Chrysler, Wirtz Exner, had a heart attack. And Tex Colbert, who was the president of Chrysler at that time, was interested in getting me to come over there at Chrysler. So we talked to Paul Ackerman, who was the vice president of engineering, a wonderful man. And we had a talk, and I wanted to bring over my team with me, which is not usually done. Mm-hmm. But I took 16 of the people from Packard with me, and Dick Teague, and all of the top guys I had with me, and placed them in positions at Chrysler, and we started out, and I was executive status at Chrysler for 2 or 3 years. And then
Remember any particular models of those 2 or 3 years at Chrysler that you're proud of?
No.
Oh, I see. Why not?
I must say, no, I don't. I had the title and the responsibility and the entire styling staff working for me, but I had a great deal of conflict with Mr. Exner. And I was not really given a free hand to do anything.
Oh, he stayed on.
He was there, but part-time.
After his recovery, huh?
And then 6 months or so later, 8 months, he came back again. And at that time, it was pretty obvious to me that I had to leave and do something else.
Was it a conflict of personality, or was it differing philosophies of design?
Well, X was a very personal guy, a capable designer. But he didn't want anybody else telling him what to do or coming up with suggestions, and he was not open to anything. And you have to admit that having a man right behind you that had the background I did was sort of a threat to him. So we took a couple trips to Europe together with our wives and so on. I liked him as a person, but we couldn't work together well. So finally, Paul Ackerman and the top management decided that they would give me a contract to be a design consultant. See, at that time I still had my own company. All since 1940 I started my own company.
Tell us a bit about that.
How did that
happen?
I started out with the technical illustration thing at the bomber plant, and we couldn't get enough people to come out to the bomber plant. Mm-hmm. So Mr. William Peock said, well, why don't you go downtown Detroit and start an office, and we'll feed you the business, you do it, and we can get the job done, because I couldn't get people to go out to Willow Run.
Right.
So I started a company called Graphic Stations. And we had 16 employees at the David Stott Building, and we did all sorts of B-24 bomber work.
Graphic stations?
Graphic station.
Graphic station.
When I went to Ford Design, of course, they had authorized me to do this. It was okay, but I couldn't do anything with automobiles, strictly bomber work.
May I actually ask you a question? Did you do any work on the privateer?
Yes.
I was in the Navy, and I remember.
Is that right?
That. Yeah, right, yeah.
As a matter of fact, I just gave the photographs of that to this Phil Lundy from the Yankee Air Force.
Yes, right.
We designed and built a single-tail privateer for the Navy.
Did you really?
And made full-size models of it, and I just sent all those photographs out to his museum.
Oh, dear.
And got there since 1942, I think, right. Or something like
Johnny
that.
Johnny Najar remembers coming back from one of his hiatuses and seeing your model of the privateer tail assembly around the plant.
Yeah. Right. And we had a B-24 nose bomber with a nose cone on it and a turret and so on, too.
Yeah.
Well, to continue just briefly on my own company, when I left Ford Motor Company, I told Jim Nance I had this company and I wasn't about to disband it, but I would refrain from anything in the automotive industry. So we did boats and appliances for Amana and RCA television. We did everything other than car stuff, but I maintained my company. When I went to Chrysler, I told Paul Ackerman I had the company and I wasn't about to give it up. And he said, it's not necessary as long as you don't do anything in the automotive field. So I had my company all these years, from 40 on.
You kept pretty much the same personnel?
And it grew and grew and grew. And pretty soon, by the time I was having difficulty at Chrysler, management-wise, the company was booming. So I had changed the name then to William Schmidt Associates. Ray Powers, who was the top executive over at Studebaker Packard, said, you shouldn't call it that. Put your own name on it, because you can't build a name like Graphic Station.
Right.
But you can build a name around a person.
Yeah.
And he was right, and I started William Schmidt Associates in about 55. So when the time came in 59 that I was about ready to leave, and I got a contract, a very considerable contract, to do a series of full-size models and so on, I opened up my own studio with a big clay modeling operations and took a lot of the Chrysler people with me. They came out once a week, had reviews. I did a line of Plymouths and a line of Chryslers.
Do you remember any particular models of that era?
Well, I do, and I have photographs of them. As a matter of fact, they're in my book. But none of them ever saw the light of day production-wise.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the ideas were used,
but not
the complete cars. So when that terminated, then I went
Bill, who was at Chrysler in those days? Top manager was Bill.
Bill Newberg was there for a short time after Tex Colbert.
Colbert.
And then Lynn Townsend came.
Then Lynn Townsend.
Yeah.
Were the Zeter brothers, was Jim Zeter
Jim
still?
Jim Zeter was still in engineering, but more in a consulting role. Yeah. He's a fine guy.
Yeah.
I used to go on fishing trips with Jim. Yeah. Just a nice guy. I went to Europe with Lynn Townsend, and one of the jobs at that time was Lynn was vice president of International before he became president. We went over to Europe to buy a company. We looked at a great many companies, and they finally bought part of the Fiat operation. Can't think of the name now, oddly enough, but I was looking at it from a product standpoint. Lynn was looking at it from a business standpoint, and they had an attorney with us, and Bob Loughner was with us, who was an ex-Packard man, went to Chrysler when I did. And he was the vice president of administration. So we had a pretty good team. We traveled around Europe for quite a few weeks. And then Lynn became president of Chrysler. At that time, I left, and...
excuse me, one more question. Was Don Kopka there at Chrysler when you were there?
Yes, he was in charge of one of the studios. I can't think of which one, but he was still there.
Yeah. Was there... one more question. Was there the Ghia-built... a show car that went down on the Andrea Doria, were you involved with that?
Yes, I didn't do that. Verge Exner did that.
Oh, he did that. Uh-huh. Yeah. What was the name of it? Do you remember it?
I can picture it, but I can't remember.
It's sitting at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean.
It's still there. It's still there, yeah. No, I can't remember the name of it. And then Chrysler started to have some real problem with their big fins that X had on the cars. And they were losing penetration, and the dealers were screaming. One day I got a call from Lynn Townsend, and sitting across the street in my other office. I said, I want to come out and see you. And he came out in an old black Plymouth with a driver and said, we want you to come back to Chrysler and be our vice president of design. I said, Lynn, I'm not going back into a big company. I've got my own company. I enjoy it. I have my freedom. I'll be your design consultant, like Mr. Walker was with Ford. So he said, well, if that's the only way we can get you back, okay, I'll talk to Mr. General who was in charge of the coal company, became chairman of the board of Chrysler.
Love?
Love.
Yes.
Mr. Love.
Yes.
So he talked to Mr. Love. Mr. Love said, I think it's a good idea. We want him to do it. So I wrote up a contract, the same that I remember George Walker did.
Ah, good.
Because I remember George used to brag to us that he was getting $1,000 a day from Ford. Mr. Breach signed a contract with $365,000 a year plus expenses and shows. So I wrote up the same kind of contract. They approved the contract, and I was to start within a month when George Walker took Elwood Engel over and introduced him, and George Walker sold the top management and Elwood getting the job. Because he would move in as vice president and be in the company rather than as a consultant. I wouldn't go back in other than a consultant.
It's a good move on your part, I think.
Well, it sure turned out to be that way. Lynn Townsend, in my estimation, was a financial man.
Yes.
But he never had car feel.
He'd come from Tooch, Bailey, Ross.
Right.
Yes.
And you know, like, you take Mr. Breach or Mr. Crusoe, even Mr. Nance, they had car feel. They understood what you're trying to do. Lynn Townsend was a bottom line figure, and very ruthless individual. I liked him fine. He treated me fine, but he stepped on a lot of people. In my estimation, he did a lot of harm to Chrysler Corporation.
Yeah.
The man that followed him didn't really have the feel either.
One of his proteges, John Ricardo.
John Ricardo. I don't think he was other than a financial man.
Another accountant.
Right. You take a man like Mr. Iacocca, he has car feel.
Yeah.
And look what's happened to that company. He's a strong, strong man.
What they needed.
Nobody else could have done the job. He had to have the power, the authority, and the right decisions, you know. And he had the guts to do it. And I think he's done a tremendous job.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be a pleasure to work for a guy.
Wouldn't it, though? What was your impression on the inside, outside of Elwood Engel's tenure at Chrysler? Did he encounter the same frustrations that you did there?
Well, Elwood is a different type of personality. Elwood is a damn good designer. He's not an administrator. As a matter of fact, it became so obvious that within a month or two of the time he came in as vice president, they appointed a John, somebody as his administrative head to handle the office, the administration, the hiring, the firing, the union problems. And And Elwood just had to design cars. He had to make no speeches or presentations or anything. He was good at that. He was a flippant type of individual, all walking around flipping a coin. And I liked Elwood very much, and we got along well. His was a difficult task because engineering still controlled the package too much at Chrysler.
They never quite got promoted.
Never got out of that.
Ford had somehow worked its way out of that in the 50s.
Well, Ford moved more towards product planning. Product planning controlled the package at Ford. But Chrysler product planning was a very weak thing. And it was really engineering controlled everything.
They'd had a long tradition of excellent engineering, starting with Walter and into Fred Zeder.
And Paul Ackerman was very strong. Right. And then after him, Al Loughborough took over the reins. And he's very strong, but not styling conscious. Paul Ackerman was very open-minded and a damn top executive. Al Loughborough was a very good executive and a good engineer, but he had very little belief in styling sales cars. So he had a lot to overcome. And after Elwood, Dick McAdam had the same job now. Dick McAdam is a man that took over as vice president of engineering at Chrysler when Elwood left. And he started with me in Packard. When I was at Packard, Dick came in. He was an insurance man, and he always wanted to design cars. He'd gone to school to do it and so on. His wife said, well, you're a young man. We don't have any children yet. If you're going to do it now. And he told me that story, and I hired him. Well, Dick just worked out to be great at Packard. He was one of the men I took with me to Chrysler, and eventually he became vice president. And did a good job. A very capable guy. It took a lot out of Dick. He aged quickly under the pressures and so on.
Oh, yeah.
After a short period of time, Don De La Rosa came over from Ford and took his job.
Oh, that's what happened.
Don is now vice president.
Did you know Bill Newberg at all? Jim Zeder once told me that he hired Bill Newberg, and he was very sorry when the end came so awkwardly for them all.
Well, I guess I'd rather not get into the details of Bill Newberg.
I agree.
I like Bill. I don't think he was a capable executive. I don't think he was an honest man. I'd like to leave it there.
Good. So at the end of the 50s decade, you're a successful independent design consultant. You have your own company. Things are looking pretty good.
We've been very fortunate since that time. We have.
But one more thing. But you didn't get the Chrysler design consultant post.
No, I didn't.
But you retained your contacts within the industry.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
And it's been a tremendous value since then, you know, my business today.
Right.
Most of our work is transportation-oriented. Yeah. We do cars and trucks and boats and planes and appliances and robots and computers. And today we do everything. And we have a nice setup. I have a small design force here. I have a complete prototype shop about 4 minutes away from here where we build full-size clay models of cars and trucks and so on. And then I have a complete production facility up north where we make limousines.
Port Sanilac.
We turn out 6 limousines a week, and we build convertibles, and we build special classic cars and so on. So it's a nice thing. I love it, and I enjoy the car business, you know.
But we've got 25 years to cover, Bill, between 1960 and 1985. What happened after you left Chrysler?
Well, I came out here.
Which is in Harper Woods.
We had about 22 designers and 15 layout people and maybe 8 modelers. And they had this building and the building across the street and another one out for a prototype shop. And it became a pretty tremendous sales thing just to meet all the salaries of these very expensive people. And so about 10 years ago, I decided to take it easy and go down to my home in Key Largo and paint and fish and relax. So I took 3 months off, and I didn't like it at all. I said, that's not for me. I got tired of painting, and I got tired of catching fish, and I got tired of playing tennis in the morning. I wanted to talk to people and have lunches, and the challenge of designing your peers. So I came back, and I said, I'm going to make the business a little smaller and keep it to about 10 designers. but excellent accounts. And so now we have some very top-notch accounts. And we do a lot of automobiles. And I do about 2 cars a year now for different companies.
You, in terms of industrial design, how did you build? You've been working with it all through the 50s, but in the 60s you went at it full time, pretty much.
Right.
And what sort of markets did you feel that you were most expert in? And what kind of accounts and what kind of companies did you work for in the last 50 years?
Well, for instance, U.S. Steel was one of our biggest accounts. For U.S. Steel, we designed a taxi cab, a military truck, truck cab using new steels and high tensile steels and galvanized steels to show the industry what could be done. We've been designing robots for Copper World Robotics. We've been designing all the tractors and combines for Ellis Chalmers nationwide and all their clients. We have accounts where we're doing, we have Northern Telecom, which is Bell Telephone of Canada. We design all their computers, their printers, their video screens, CRTs, and we've had that account for 12 years. They're nice accounts, you know, they're big. We have Accello, and we design all kinds of products for Accello. We have, we have Perco down in Miami. We design marine hardware for boats and so on.
Marine hardware. What do you do for Accello?
Accello is a new products application study. They have new products, they don't know what to do with them. We have concept studies, come up with new products and apply them to the field, automotive, household, marine and so on, and apply those products, and their management gets into a new product field. It's concept design.
Uh-huh.
Very exciting.
That's right. It must be, right?
Oh, yeah. It is.
Did you hang on to the Amana account?
Had it for about 15 years, and then one of my top people, Jerry Pink, went to